Our journey through February covers a vast spiritual territory. We begin right where January left us in the 5th chapter of Matthew, sitting at the feet of Jesus as he delivers the Sermon on the Mount. This massive teaching event that fills chapters 5, 6, and 7 of Matthew. Here, Matthew establishes Jesus as the new Moses, the one who brings a new Torah, a new law. Jesus reinterprets Old Testament Torah as found in Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy into the new ethic, pattern, and mission of God's own unfolding kingdom. Jesus gives a new structure for life as a disciple, radical generosity and service, a pattern of prayer as a cherished child of God, humble servants, humble sincere piety, political and social dynamics based on forgiveness and mercy, and patience and courage in the face of conflict and persecution. The Sundays after Epiphany culminate on February 19th with a true mountaintop experience, the glorious transfiguration of Jesus reveals his divine identity and glory. The voice of God reveals Jesus' identity and mission. God identifies Jesus as God's one and only child and as the beloved, God's one and only faithful servant whose suffering saves the world. In an instant, our imaginations are cast forward to Holy Week, to the cross and the empty tomb. But God snaps us back into the present mission of Jesus with these final words, "Listen to him." As Jesus' transfiguration glory fades and we follow him back down the mountain, our attention is now fully fixed on Jesus. We are ready to enter the season of Lent. Ash Wednesday is our portal into the 40 days of Lent. Through confession of sin and the ashen cross on our foreheads, we freely embrace our mortality and humanity, opening ourselves to the liberating and life-giving love and grace of God. February concludes with the first Sunday in Lent, drawing us into the raw, unsheltered wilderness with Jesus, who, alone and vulnerable, faces down all that seeks to turn us away from God. And now we see the true faith and power of the Beloved. The Gospel of Matthew portrays Jesus as the classic authoritative teacher. And you could say the Sermon on the Mount is his masterpiece. In it, we can find most of the significant themes relevant to the remainder of Matthew's story about Jesus. As Jesus begins, the audience is apparently his closest disciples. When he ends, the audience is much broader. The primary theme of the sermon is righteousness or justice. The content that follows will give the specifics. Jesus' teaching opens with the Beatitudes, which we heard last week. They point out God's favor towards humanity rather than God's demand. And they're not the expected cultural categories. People who mourn are recognized favorably. Developing an active strategy in peacemaking is hardly popular in first century life under Rome. And the sermon closes with God's demand to obey Jesus' words, that is, the new Torah. God grants favor but demands the very lives of the ones who follow. As we find ourselves in the second week of passages from Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, as recounted by Matthew, we are again faced with the temptation to hear Jesus' words as requirement rather than blessing, as command rather than commissioning. But Jesus doesn't say, if you want to become salt and light, do this. Or before I'll call you salt and light, I'll need to see this from you. Rather, he says both simply and directly, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. It is, as with last week's Beatitudes, sheer blessing, commendation, affirmation, and commissioning. Jesus does go on to say that salt that has lost its saltiness is useless, and that light wasn't made to be put under a bushel, which might imply for some that there is indeed a threat hiding amid this pronouncement. But I wonder, can salt really lose its saltiness? Doesn't it just dissolve? And are candles ever put under bushel baskets? Wouldn't that snuff the flame out, or worse, start a fire? Maybe Jesus is implying that one can lose one's status as salt and light. Or maybe he's just naming the absurdity of the possibility of losing one's character as salt and light in order to underscore the reliability and resilience of the gift he bequeaths. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. That's the way it is, and that's the way it will stay, period. There are statistics about a child's self-esteem in relation to the messages they hear. Psychologists suggest that for every negative message elementary age children hear about themselves, they need to hear 10 positive ones to restore their self-esteem to where it had been previously. Children, to put it another way, become what they are named. Call a child bad long enough, and they will believe you. Call a child, or teen or adult for that matter, worthless or unlovable or shameful, and eventually they and all of us will live into the name we've been assigned. In the same way, call us good or useful, dependable, helpful, or worthwhile, and we'll grow into that identity and behavior as well. Jesus says, you are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Jesus doesn't give the disciples instructions on how to become salt and light. Rather, he just plain tells them that that's what they are. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. He doesn't even say that they're little lights that they should let shine. Rather, he says they are the light of the world. Sheer promise and declaration. We have been commissioned to season and preserve the world, to let our light shine so that others will see our good works and glorify God. Jesus isn't asking us to earn our salvation, but to live out the salvation and discipleship that has been given to us as a gift. In Jesus' usage, the light is not simply to allow others to see whatever they wish, but it is for others to witness the acts of justice that Jesus' followers perform. Beyond that, it allows us to recognize the cause of these actions, the God of heaven. Now, we have a hard time believing that we are good, worthy, and lovable, and therefore, you know, we'll perhaps politely nod when called salt and light, but not really believe it. So this week, start thinking about a salt and light log. Start collecting examples of where God has worked through you to help someone else. This may be difficult for many of us who were taught never to boast. Or more accurately, we were taught that saying anything good about ourselves publicly is boasting. So you can practice by pointing out where you see someone else being salt or light, but then also look and see where God is using you as salt and light too. Because that is what the gospel calls Christians to do, to be the light of the world, to do things that are countercultural, even counterintuitive, for the sake of love of neighbor. That mandate is neither new nor unique to Christianity. The law of Moses envisions a just society ruled by generosity rather than raw self-interest, including special protections for the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. Time and time again, the Hebrew prophets call their listeners back to the law, back to sharing your bread with the hungry and bringing the homeless poor into your house, back to offering food to the hungry and help to the afflicted, back to fair scales, fair wages, and Sabbath rest. By doing this in poetry, the prophets do this calling back not by making a coldly logical case, but by crafting a lyrical argument that startles the hearers with urgency and emotion. In this week's Old Testament reading, the prophet voices God's frustration at the hypocrisy of people of faith who are meticulous in their religious practices but fail at righteousness. In other words, they make no connections between their life of faith and their everyday actions. Worship happens over here. Real life happens over there. And neither has much bearing on the other, despite the fact that Mosaic tradition weaves the two together like the threads of a rope. The opening lines of our reading are a loud jolt that grabs the attention not only of the reader, but also the prophet, who is addressed by God and told to shout, sound his voice like a trumpet, and announce the people's rebellion. The volume immediately diminishes. God is reflective, if also incredulous and a little sarcastic, about the hypocrisy of the people. The poem crescendos as God's voice rises in response to the people's complaint. Why do we fast, but you do not see? The series of divine rhetorical questions grows louder and more strident until the call to do justice erupts into a series of positive consequences. Your light shall break forth. Your healing shall spring up. You will be flanked by God's glory, and God will answer your cries for help. The challenge of living a faithful, righteous life is just as acute today as it was in the ancient world. We can file this under Ecclesiastes' observation that there is nothing new under the sun. Yet there is much we can do as a congregation to live out our call to be salt and light. What's burning inside you that you want to share? What gift you've been given that might contribute to the welfare of this congregation or community or world? This may become clearer as you realize ways God is already using you. But who might be a good tutor at a local school? What group might use the church building during the week? Who has extra time to work on a habitat project? What members of all ages can help the local community preschool with its website? And who can extend Christian care to those inside and outside the congregation who need someone to listen to, care for, and love them? Jesus called us salt and light, and that's what we are. Building on last week's reading, who are the salt of the earth? They are the humble, the ones who mourn, the meek, and those who thirst after doing what is right in the world. Who are light? They are the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, and those who receive abuse for standing up for what is right. Who are the salt of the earth? Who are the light of the world? You are. Thanks be to God.